Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with set designer, stage manager, sound and lighting technician, event planner, videographer, technical director, and combat instructor, Steve Pat Magrian. As you can hear from that list, there is virtually nothing that Steve cannot do when it comes to creating an environment for a play in a theater, for a party in an event, for an event, well, for pretty much anything. You want to create something, Steve can design it, he can construct it, he can videotape it. There's really nothing he can't do. And the story of the way he became all of these many things is interesting, charming, and instructive. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
is about being the person you really are, not the person you think you have to be, not the person they told you you had to be, or in so many cases, the person they told you you were, even though that wasn't the truth, not the person you are attempting to be because you think it will get you loved or hired or safe. Not even the person you may currently think you are. Because ironically, unfortunately, as a therapist, it is clear to me that many of us are in denial for some important aspects of ourselves. We have decided that it is safer to pretend that some of the things that we were as a child, we actually weren't. And we get so good at that pretense that we even believe it ourselves. And so we come into adulthood presenting what I call our cover story. Just like a spy has a cover story, and the spy pretends to be something he or she is not because it would be dangerous if people really knew who they were, it is the same thing with us. We decide it is dangerous to be or present or demonstrate something about ourselves, and so we find a way to hide it. We create a cover story which finally we believe. Unfortunately, unlike the spy, who can leave the cover story behind when he or she is done with their assignment, we do not. We carry it with us. And it makes life so much harder than it has to be. The Lynn Show is about saying that if this happened to you, it may not be too late to recover some of those things which you had to deny, to take off the cover story and be the real person that you are. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in Steve Batmagrian, whose interview I am airing today, what you can hear is what it sounds like when you are willing to be all that you are. When the circumstances of life present something to you that you may not have known you were interested in, had skills for, wanted, or even were, but when you see it, you know it, and you embrace it, that is Steve's story. And I'm so delighted to be able to play this interview for you so you can hear what it sounds like when a person embraces all that he is. So here now is Steve Batmagrian. Okay, so I'm here with Steve Batmagrian, and I am explaining to Steve that I interview people who make their living or their life within art. Have you got a definition that you like to use for yourself?
Artisan. I don't actually consider myself an artist. I'm more of a designer. I've never, ever that I can recall, created something for my own enjoyment because I felt moved to do something. If you got something, I can do it for you. So I paint, I sculpt, my degree is in interior design and commercial space planning, and have worked in the theater for 40 years as a technical director and designer, prop builder. I've often described what I do as illusionary carpentry, because you are creating illusion. As the actor is pretending to be somebody else, I have to allow the audience to believe that they're in a sewer in Paris or on the moon. So it's an illusion. It's magic.
Okay, so I only have this one question, and it is, do you know when this began for you?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
I was lucky enough growing up here in Sarasota. We had a neighbor, and she was a volunteer in the costume department at the old Players Theater. And so a couple of times when we were in junior high school, we went to some of the dress rehearsals. And this was fun. We'd always gone to the theater in Chicago. My mother being an artist, father was a conductor. He was a music instructor. And his brother was a concert violinist. So I grew up in an artistic household, and for the most part, I resisted that.
But still, you were steeped in it.
I was steeped in it, and, we had an art gallery and studio in Chicago, so, you know, my hands were always in the plaster. I was always doing that, but I was attracted to the sciences. I was really wanted to, Jacques Cousteau and all of that stuff, and then moving to Florida, wow, that was even more encouragement. We had friends that were going to get me work at Moat Marine. But in high school, me and a buddy of mine decided to swing by the Players backstage. And we walked in backstage and said, yeah, we'd like to, you know, see if there's anything we can do. And I meet the stage manager, Josephine Richard. And I think she was probably about 80 years old. She's an ex-Ziegfeld Follies girl and just the ballsiest old dame you could ever meet. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and says, you look strong. Why don't you go upstairs and help the guys on the fly floor? At the old Players Theater, fly floor was as old school as it gets. No counterweights. You climbed up wooden boards up the side to a level that was just hundreds of ropes. It was basically to lift the backdrop, two men, hand over hand, three ropes, and tied it down. It was exactly like being on a sailing ship. Well, I was 15, first year in high school. And there's three men up there, volunteers. And so they told me what I needed to do, and I did it. But that aha moment was, you know, looking down onto the stage, and the scene is set, and the lights go off, and we do our thing, and the lights come back up, and it's something else. And it sort of clicked. All the different types of things that I'd been exposed to all sort of made sense. The art, the music, the sculptural aspects of it, you know, the singing and dancing, you know, all that. And from that day, I didn't miss a rehearsal for any show for the next 3 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Worked with different designers and technical directors. And when I was 18 years old, was appointed a designer and technical director of the Sarasota Players. They had just moved into their new building the year before. So I did their first summer season, and then into their winter season. And for some reason, which is never really explained, they decided they were going to cut the salary on that position by $2,000.
Oh, my God.
Which, at that point, was a lot of money, because I would spend at least that much on pizza and beer to keep the crew around.
Oh.
I mean, that was, you know, that way.
Because everybody's volunteering.
Everybody's volunteering, and especially it's tough to get, you know, young, strong people to do the scene changes and do all sorts of stuff. And I was able to entice my compadres at school, and we had an incredible crew, proud of what they did. The respect that was reflected back on us by the people we worked with, I can't even put a word around how that affected everybody. And this may sound strange. In that first year, I find myself drinking beer, younger than I was supposed to be, with my ex-junior high school principal, because him and his wife were volunteers in that. And so they would, you know, we were given responsibilities, we fulfilled our obligation, and were given the respect.
And you were part of the group, even though you were so young, right?
Yeah. That is what's so healthy about community theater, is that there's a mix of ages and backgrounds and motivations, why people become involved. And so that, again, it was just like, I think back now, it says, what the hell were they thinking?
They were thinking that you were young, you were strong, you were smart, and you were available.
And I had relationships with all of the gentlemen and ladies that were the backbone of the production end of the theater. And they were all 60, 70, 80-year-old people. And I'd worked alongside of them for all these years. So there was a level of understanding and respect that allowed me to be able to tell this 80-year-old man, no, you got to do this again. This isn't right. I know you think this is the right way. You know, so my ability to communicate came mostly from the ability to listen.
Well, I'm thinking that it's not only that you were developing the technical skills of what you were doing, but you were also developing management skills.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Years later, when I was down in Venice, I mean, the youngest guy on my crew was 70 years old. And, you know, being able to identify the strengths. This man may be strong as an ox, but he's got bad eyes. This guy has got great eyes, but can't, you know. So you put the two of those guys together, boy, you've got
a great team. So now you're 18. Is that a paying position?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
You already have a job. You have a career, right? So what happens?
When I was told that they were cutting the salary, I says, well...
Well, wait a minute. You were using your salary to buy pizza and beer for the...
Sure.
You know, when you said it, I thought, oh, this must be in the budget, but it's not. It's
no, this
yours.
This is what I felt I needed to do.
I see.
And if that went away, it would be much harder to do. But from there, I went to the Golden Apple. Had been open 2 or 3 years at that point and was really, you know, getting some headway. And what I did originally for them was take shows on the road. I would get a phone call and say, Steve, the truck's ready to go. And they'd hand me a set of plans, and I would drive a U-Haul truck packed full of scenery to Kansas City, and then set it up with whoever they had to help the setup, which generally meant it was like inner-city busboys. You know, it was not any theater people. And the theater that we were installing this in was an old Fox movie house in Kansas City. So to take a show that was on the postage stamp-sized stage that they had at the Golden Apple, and then take it to... You know, it was like putting a tennis court on a soccer field. So often the set had to be augmented with additional pieces that may have never actually been attached to the set.
Right.
You know, it's just like, keep on building, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so that was real interesting. Again, I wasn't really old enough to be able to drive the rental truck. And from there, they were actually sending shows to Windsor, Canada, to Kansas City, and at the Midnight Sun Dinner Theater in Atlanta. But in between that, I'd worked as their master carpenter.
Talk about on-the-job training. Yeah. I mean, really, by the time you thought about what you might want to do, you already knew how to do it.
I'm kind of a sponge. I know how to listen.
Yeah.
I don't assume to know something. Even if I know it and somebody is trying to communicate with me, it's not going to hurt me to listen.
That's not a common quality, I think. I think so many people are addicted to being right that they can't listen, especially if they know something and somebody wants to tell them something, right?
Yeah, that was something I took from my family experience.
I was just going to ask where you thought you got that from. So can you say more about that?
Well, we always ate at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, we always talked. You know, whether or not Jeopardy was on the TV and, you know, we were answering all that. And my mother was an interesting artist in her background. She came from West Virginia, as country a girl as you could ever want. She was offered a scholarship in designing aircraft or the Art Institute Chicago. She went to the Art Institute Chicago. I mean, just both, again, that's a left and right brain.
Yes, exactly.
And I've always had to deal with that myself, is that I very, very much balanced.
Right, the division between the two and you is very thin.
Yeah. Emotionally, I'm very close to the surface.
Yeah.
Although I appear to be fairly hidden person, I'm not.
No.
And again, from my background with all these arts, and plus an extra little dynamic, which I don't really know how this has anything to do with it, but my father is from Iran.
Oh.
So as Iranian,
it's an entirely different culture.
A completely different culture, and that is one of the elements that dealing with.
My
as a
goodness,
child.
Your father's from Iran and your mother's
from West Virginia.
I'm
from the deep end of the gene pool.
You are. Yeah. I mean, you're all these contradictions.
Multicultural,
exactly.
And he came to Chicago to go to the conservatory. My parents met working at the YMCA. Big cities, the YMCA is a hotel.
Yes.
And so mom was at the front desk and my dad was in the haberdashery.
Working their way through their respective schools.
Yes.
Oh,
and
amazing.
Again, I have a lot of spices.
It's true. And how open they must have been to have considered each other an option.
Well, they were both, you know,
well, they were young.
18, 19 years old.
Yeah, they were young. And they were both pursuing an art. I mean, they must have had that very powerfully in common. But still, I imagine that their choice of spouse was not their family's first choice.
It was pretty hard
to
understand that.
I'll bet.
You know, my grandfather was one of like seven brothers. Half of them were preachers and half of them were alcoholics.
Right.
So, you know, and grandfather really wasn't either. He was just a hardworking man. But
so they took a huge risk to have each other.
Oh, absolutely.
Amazing. And that also says a lot about who they were individually and what they would pass on to their children.
And my understanding of what that process was has helped me a lot in my coming of age. My parents did divorce. Those elements that we just identified as what brought them together was overshadowed by the male ego. Dad couldn't be as successful as he wanted to show his family, so he became had an import-export business. My dad was brilliant. He could do all sorts of things. But at that point, for a man to be successful, he had to have a secretary on the side.
Yeah, right.
And he also expected us to accept
that, because that's part of their culture. Right.
And
but not your mom's.
No, it affected her health.
Oh.
And here I am at 9, 10 years old, that when this is going on, this is when I'm identifying what my maleness would be.
Right.
And I saw how his decisions, his selfish decisions, is what
hurt
her. And then we came to Florida, sort of, you know, it was just like...
Yeah. So the caretaking becomes a big part of your way of being in the world, right?
Yeah.
And And that's
Let me deal with it. I'll take care of it.
Right? Yeah. Right, I'll take care of it. And, of course, that's part of what makes you so good at what you do. Not only do you have all the skills, but you're so easy to work with because you just want to take care of everything, right? Yeah. And so everybody can feel safe knowing that you're going to do it,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. I'm sure that's what everybody saw in you.
It seems to be a repeat performance.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. Imagine it's not that easy to always take that position. But it rarely is. I'm sure that's right. But it must be part of what makes you so desirable.
Yeah, I've rarely withdrawn from a challenge.
Oh, I'm sure. I can't imagine that you use the word no very often.
I joke. It says my mother never told me how to say no.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure that's right.
You may not get a chance to do something that could be that great again.
Yes, everything's an opportunity. I got it. Okay, so here we have you at 17, 18. You're driving all over the world, creating what wasn't there, that didn't fit. And you said the last one you did was in Georgia. So then what happens?
I left at the Golden Apple.
Okay, so how old were you when you left?
Probably 21, maybe.
Okay.
And it was pretty obvious that really you needed to have some sort of sheepskin that said that, you know, I've stayed in one place long enough for you to give a credential of some sort. And with Mom being an instructor at Ringling, I had the opportunity to go to Ringling, and I enrolled. I'd really only expected to go 1 year. I enrolled in the interior design department. I expected to pick up some rendering techniques and period furniture knowledge, and I'd be 3 years later, I graduated. They allowed my projects to focus on things that I had some possibility of gaining something from, out of the mainstream of their normal curriculum,
yeah.
And that was great. So I designed theaters, I designed zoos. The national launch of a product called Fabri-Track was here at the Hyatt. They had invited all the interior designers, and Cynthia Duval, who was our antiques teacher, and her husband had gone to that, and he picked up on it. So there's money to be made here. I started to work with him, ended up working with a distributor. So I did that for a couple of years, did some big offices and things like that, up until the point where the home company saw that that's where the money was. And all of a sudden, I had a contract for like 10 banks to do interior.
They took it.
While I was at Ringling, I became involved with many of my fellow students in the medieval fair. And our little troop of artists, also many people from New College, got involved in doing the human chess match, which is sort of championship wrestling with dangerous stuff. It's Ooh. All choreographed, just like championship wrestling, but you are swinging swords and things like that. And I was really good at it. It's the only real performance stuff I've done because I was the bad guy. The chess match was, you know, good guys versus bad guys. You know, the French versus the English, the barbarians versus the Christians, or, you know, whatever year's theme it was. And, again, I was able to fall into the role. I was king of the chess match on a few years, but I was also a pawn and a rook. And
oh, so you could be the bad guy no matter what you were?
Yeah. There's a hardcore group of people that start them often, and it's a group called the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronisms. And it's a medieval sort of nerds club. There are hundreds of thousands of members around the world, but they have kingdoms all around the country, and they practice medieval arts. The women crochet and knit, and the men make armor, and they actually battle themselves. They have weapons with padding, and they actually go out there and beat the hell out of each other. Okay, they do a thing in Pennsylvania called the Penzic Wars. There are 20,000 people that camp out for, like, weeks, and they have battles. You work your way up through the hierarchy of... But these are sort of like intellectual nerds, but they're...
But they're physical.
But they're physical.
Yeah.
The thing of it was, is that they're doing it... It's their fantasy.
Yes, that's right.
It wasn't my fantasy. Uh-huh. My job was to make you believe that I'm the bad guy.
Yes,
I don't have to believe
to be
I'm the bad guy.
No.
First year, the fight choreographer was Peter Ivanov. Peter recognized me as that I was doing it for the performance part
yes.
of it. I graduated Ringling in 79, and in 1980, I was hired by the education department at the museum to be the grounds coordinator for the medieval fair. They saw that my space planning skills and all the other things that I brought to the table, again, I was doing this wall covering stuff Well, Peter was hired to do a show down in Venice, and he suggested that they hire me to do the set. Again, I fell into place. They fell in love with me. It was also the summer that they had decided to put a fly system in.
Oh, nice.
And did an orchestra pit at the same time. So you think about Florida, when you cut 6 2-foot by 2-foot holes in your roof to drop in steel, it often lets an awful lot of water in, too.
Oh, God.
So we had to fight. And of course, when they dug out the orchestra pit, they took all that dirt and put it up on stage with the water. Still had to open on time. So, I dealt with it.
I'll take care of it.
I'll take care of it, right?
Right.
I did a season with a variety of directors, and we were lucky enough to lure John Duvall away from the Manatee Players, where he'd been for 10 or 15 years, had created an incredible program there. And when he came down to Venice, he was able to attract actors from Fort Myers to St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
And the Venice Little Theaters, the quality just skyrocketed. It was great to work with. He was a designer, so I just had to implement his design. And we did just as good a show as you'd ever want to see.
And here you are now in the theater.
Yeah.
Right?
And 2 or 3 seasons into it, the board is all puffed up on how great their theater is, and they didn't put him on the play reading committee. You know, they think the success of the theater is because of their stellar decisions.
Yes, right, of course.
And, of course, at that point, also the play reading committee was also in the midst of starting theater works. So there was a bit of a weirdness. So he resigned.
Wow. Oh.
And I followed. And it's funny because just the other day I found my letter of resignation. And, you know, I had said how much I loved working with him, the people. It was, you know, it was always about money. They want me to formulate a budget without a script. They said they couldn't afford to get me a perusal script.
You mean they chosen the play, but they wouldn't give you a script?
Could get any idea of what, I mean, yes, I've heard of that show. Just prior to this, had arranged to have my marriage on stage at the Venice Little Theater. Okay. So the last line of my letter of resignation, I'm hoping that my decision to leave the employee of the Venice Theater is not going to affect my having my wedding here. and it didn't. Actually got married on the end of the Yellow Brick Road, which was still painted on stage.
And, wow.
So that was, you know, that was great.
So then what did you do?
I was hired by the Manatee Players.
Uh-huh.
And so we went on our honeymoon to went to the Edinburgh Theater Festival.
Oh.
And actually, in 3 weeks, 3 weeks of the festival, it's great because not only is this is the legitimate theater festival, then they have the Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there is a jazz festival, a beer festival, and a book festival, all going on in Edinburgh at the same time.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, it was great. Yeah, I had had roommates from Scotland. Scottish guys and their German girlfriends were my roommates. We had the International House of Pancakes. And we stayed with the Samsons in Glasgow, and we'd take the train over and do theater all day, all night, and come back. About halfway through, I got a phone call from my uncle in Cyprus. He says, there's tickets waiting for you to come to Cyprus. This actually happened just before we left. So it's just like, how do you pack for Scotland
and Cyprus? Cyprus, right.
We managed. So I went to Cyprus for a couple of days, went out in the Mediterranean, then went back. But came back and started at the Manatee Players. When John left, they had hired a director who came out of the college world and treated everybody as if they were students. Now, when you have the age range of people who have been doing it there for a long time, and he didn't want to hear it the way we used to do it. Basically, when I got there, I had 1 75-year-old woman volunteer. That was it.
Oy.
I had to build all those shows by myself, design them, paint them. You know, there were some good people. I hadn't had to worry so much about the lighting. That went along pretty well. Did the first 4 of 6 shows of the season. Opening day of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. I cut my thumb in half on the table saw.
Oh, dear God.
The opening day. I was there. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was cutting some molding to be a last bit of baseboards on it. Go to the hospital. They fixed me up. Monday, I didn't have a job. And on top of that, I just bought a house.
Oh, of course.
We just bought a house.
Right. They fired you because you cut your finger?
Well, they said it was a show-by-show contract. Although they just told my mortgage company that, no, he's got a contract here for the season.
Oh, my God.
I'm left-handed. So, I mean, it wasn't like I still could work. But then trying to find, you know, now I've got pin.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm a carpenter. You want to hire me? I may be a halfway good actor, but not that good.
No.
Everything we owned went up for sale.
Oh, my God.
My wife's car, she had a brand new little Honda Civic, and that sold. I gave her my van, and we got back from our honeymoon on Saturday night. On Sunday morning, I get a phone call from Doogie Sampson. Hey, Doogie, what's up? He says, well, Birgit and I got stopped at a roadblock, and we're in jail. Our visas were past due, and they're deporting us. But our van is sitting in a junkyard in Alamogordo, New Mexico. You can have the van, but everything we own is in the van. So now here, I've just spent 3 weeks in Scotland, best 3 weeks of my life.
Right.
Spent every cent we had. I had to go borrow money from an old girlfriend to be able to get a one-way plane ticket. I fly out there. Here I'm in El Paso. Get a shuttle bus to take me out to the prison, and it's like Cool Hand Luke. You know, it's all barbed wire and cameras and stuff. I'm here to pick up some paperwork from Douglas Sampson. Hold on a minute. Nope, no Douglas Sampson here. No, he's got to be here. Nope, sorry, he's not on our register. So I go, I'm sitting on the curb, you know, I got my little bag. Excuse me, sir. We just found out he's at the airport. We passed each other. He was able to leave the paperwork at Delta. So I had to then go back to the airport to get the paperwork, then hire a shuttle to take me to Alamogordo, New Mexico, across the White Sands Desert. When I finally get there, I mean, it's really like that classic. You may have seen that photograph of all the old sort of hillbillies saying, you know, our crack staff is here to serve you. and it literally, it's a junkyard in the middle of the desert. And I go in and say, I'm here to pick up this vehicle. I says, okay, it'll be $400 or something like that, because for every day it was there, it was getting charged. So here I'm walking across here, and several cars down, this little old man pops up. He says, you a doctor? No. And then a young girl's head pops up and says, this girl's really sick. She could really use some methadone really bad. And it's like, sorry. Can't help you. I'm just here picking up. What's going on here? They've been using this van to move drugs. Or people or whatever.
Right.
You know, what are they going to leave an ounce of pot in there and have me get arrested and get it back again?
Right.
You know, I mean, I've seen enough B movies to know how that works.
Right.
And the only bad thing I found was the liver that was in the cooler for a week.
Oh, dear.
I was like, whoa!
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
But drove back, and sort of the insult to injury. So I had to, instead of being able to drive back to Sarasota.
Right.
My wife's brother is getting married in South Carolina, so I have to drive from Alamogordo to Atlanta over, like, I guess, Labor Day weekend. As I'm going across the bridge, bam, it backfires. Yeah. Blows the mufflers off. Oh, look, there's it's a bus station and a truck stop and a garage. And I pull into the garage. Sorry, we don't have any metric tools. Because it's a Volkswagen. I said, but you want to buy some pot?
I says,
no, I really don't. So I'm able to get to a hotel and find a mechanic. And it was like Labor Day weekend. And he was just there. All I needed to get some points. The points on Volkswagens go bad. And that's what the background. But I had to drive from Vicksburg, Mississippi. And I managed to find the most expensive Holiday Inn in the world to stay in, because it's right across from the graveyard in Vicksburg. It's a tourist attraction.
Right, the tourist attraction.
So I had to drive basically from Vicksburg to Atlanta with no muffler on this Volkswagen van. So that sounded like a herd of Harley Davidsons. I was just about deaf by the time I got there. So I get to Atlanta. I get the part fixed. We go to the brother-in-law's wedding, come back to Sarasota, take the car in to get it, the Volkswagen van, to get it worked on. Guy says, you know, you got a broken crankshaft. When it backfired, it broke it, and here I've got this vehicle which is really no good to me. It doesn't have. Eventually, I made enough money to be able to put a new motor in it. I work with a guy. I help put the motor in, learn a little bit about it. I go to get the last part. And I go to this Volkswagen shop street, and I pull into this complex, and one of the bays is full of scenery. And I'd worked with all the theaters and was pretty aware. So I walk in, and it's a fella who is working out of Tampa. It's a special events production company. At that point, nobody had ever heard of that. It was mostly florists or interior designers that would do special events. But he had worked in parade float manufacture and had befriended a couple of people. There was one woman named Lucille Cogburn who had started the Crew of Venus, the social crews like they have in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. They have them in Tampa, too. They do the Gasparilla Parade and all that. So he had done her parades, and she was connected on the social level with all the country clubs. And the third partner was an ASCAP booking agent and musician. So he booked the acts, she gets them into the venues, and Mark would design the sets. They had work in Tampa and in Naples. They didn't do anything in Sarasota. She didn't have any connections here. He just had like car mechanics and house carpenters build stuff. And so the first show I did was a killer. It was a Cotton Club with Cab Calloway and Cab Calloway's daughter, full band up in Tampa. I said, this I can do this. Well, his business sense wasn't that great. They were taking advantage of him. He was getting a third of what was left, but it was only what was left was what they were telling him what was left.
Yeah, right.
He actually, at that point, was living in the back of the warehouse because he had lost his house to the doctors here in town. He had the mystery disease. He had these sort of ulcerative sores on his leg. It's like, well, it turned out, he found out after we were partners for about a year, he went to visit his brother in South Carolina. His liver stopped growing when he hit puberty. So here he's a 35-year-old man who drinks beer all day long with a liver the size of, you know.
Yeah.
So he got a liver. He ended up with, basically says, I'm going for a liver transplant. We had started our own side of the business called Display Masters. And Lee and I were, well, you know, hey.
Yeah,
let's
right.
do it. We start, and that's how New Atmosphere started. Didn't I mean, we literally backed into it. You know, I was working with him and was doing creative stuff. We were doing window displays. I did for like Jeanette's and all kinds of, you know, whatever it took. But and one of the big projects we did here was at Gulfgate. We did a huge haunted house for Gulfgate Mall, 3,500 square foot, ran for a month, designed and built it for the owners of the mall at the time. And so that got us a lot of press. Then he went away, and we started a New Atmosphere, and 25 years later.
Okay, so...
So all of a sudden, I'm out of the theater.
Yes.
And actually creating theater.
In a lot of different kinds of venues.
I've done fashion shows in parking garages. I've done parties on the roofs of buildings. You know, I've did lots of stuff for the opera. I became like the go-to guy, and it was I was kept secret.
Yeah.
Because the ladies at lunch that I was developing these relationships.
Right, and right. You're their secret weapon.
Absolutely.
Right. So why did you stop?
The sort of business model changed. About 70-80% of my business was nonprofits. So I did the symphony, the ballet, the opera, the Heart Association, Moat Marine, Spanish Point. I've got a list that's that long, along with Sex Fifth Avenue and, you know, all kinds. Not as much corporate work as we'd really hoped, but, you know, I felt privileged to actually be part of the process of raising money for all these.
Yeah,
I felt that I can't give anything, but I am.
Yes.
And that and it showed. I mean, the relationship and, you know, YMCA, I did Going for the Gold for 18 years.
Wow.
And, you know, here I find myself, I'm just sort of this big, bulky, hairy guy, sweaty guy, that, like I said, the ladies at lunch love me and involved me, you know, we're having a special dinner for all the at the Field Club. You have to be there.
Yeah, right.
Although I was uncomfortable at first, I became over the years I became more and more comfortable. The problem is that in 08 when the bottom fell out,
right.
the structuring of much of the of fundraising changed the way they approached it.
Yeah, they didn't have any money to spend.
And not that they were spending a lot of it with me, but they got a lot of bang for their buck. At that point, too, I had was forming a relationship with a couple of videographers here in town. I'd done some built some sets for a couple of commercials that they did, and this is really great. But they were operating. Think about video production; they can do it in that third bedroom.
Yeah, right.
So I designed these sets. We built them, and it was great. Boy, we'd really loved it to have a chance to do this in a soundstage situation. I said,
right.
Well, the building I'm in is owned by the doctors who also own the building next door, which is empty. And we basically, it was a perfect place. They used to actually create the rigging for sailing ships. So they had
a huge
open space. And so we partnered together. I said, well, this is great, because what they wanted to do is they had already had shows running. They had a channel up in Manatee County mm-hmm. on the cable. And what we wanted to do was give Blab TV a run for their money.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could have your show, and I would design a set for you, and you would do, and I would bring it down, and I would make my little dime here,
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have to be, like, going all over
Half Acre
do the work. Did a couple of those, but it was also, as things were sliding, their cash cow was, like, Gettle Toyota. They did, six commercials a month for them.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, when they weren't doing any commercials anymore, then they had to sort of schedule their. So I'm stuck having to, I'd let a lot of stuff go. I'd encouraged other people to handle the bar mitzvahs and the weddings
and all that kind
of stuff. I kept the big private accounts that I'd had. It really wasn't enough,
right.
Especially with the rental companies that I had for years been doing all of their lighting and sound. They'd rent them the tents. And, like 1,000 people events at the museum.
Right.
I would come in for Risk Corp and people like that. They started buying up the LED equipment and had their, all of a sudden it was just, I was not making enough money. And
right.
I always had had, for 17, 18 years, I had John Deere as a account in the summertime.
Mm.
They bring their sales reps in from all over the world to Sarasota, and I set up a city out at the polo grounds with tents and bleachers for each one of the different divisions. And they bring all of their equipment and all of their competition's equipment in for these seminars, mm-hmm. Month-long seminars. And I was a project manager.
Right.
All I had to do was make the phone calls. Work with, lay out the space, toilets, tables, chairs, tents,
right.
dumpsters, you name it. And they write me a big check. I write all the checks out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got us through the summer.
Wow.
And after 17 years, they moved to Orlando.
Oh, God.
And I couldn't do it. The hole you dig, there's not enough time at the beginning of the season to make enough money to fill that hole up that you dug all summer long.
Yeah, right.
So, it wasn't making any sense. And again, here's my I crossed paths with the Turoffs once more.
Because
mm-hmm. the Golden Apple at that point is going down for the
right.
third time.
Right.
I'd actually gotten, my wife had worked with them. They'd called me. I'd rented them some stuff. And we'd regenerate our relationship. I never thought it would happen. Well, as they were going down for the second time, they thought that they could continue on with a nonprofit they created called Plato. And I said, well, look, we're both in need of reinventing ourselves.
Right.
I says, I've got all this stuff. They looked at my property. They were maybe going to move in there because it was going to be an educational-based theater school.
Right.
And, well, we found, they ended up with a really cool location just a quarter of a mile from where my warehouse was. The lease was great. I designed this empty space. It was in a shopping center. I actually brought my inventory over. I set up drapes and sound. We had previews. They had a little restaurant at the end. We had little cabarets, and we raised money.
Actually, I think I was there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place was called Jaeger's.
Yeah, Jaeger's. I remember it, right.
And the place was in the corner. And this is could work out really cool. The lease was really accessible. There were some questions that nobody ever really wanted to ask, maybe because they didn't want to know. But we move ahead Well, it came down to the point where it was time to sign the lease. Turoff's couldn't sign the lease. Their legal issues from before.
Right.
And the board wasn't going to sign a lease because if they did it, then they were responsible for
That's right. So that didn't work out.
That didn't work out.
Right.
That didn't work out.
So then what happened?
God, what did happen? Well, I've been scrambling.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last, God, I was just trying to put it back into order here. The one of the best things that's happened to me here in the last year is that I've been working at the Oslo.
Ah.
I joke, it took me 40 years to get into the Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
And was called in. I put myself on the call list.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been a union member back in the 90s, 20 years ago. But when my business started to take off, I said, look, you know, I can't take the calls, you know.
And I don't need it.
I respectfully, you know, give it back. Well, you can actually get on the call list, pay your $20, and you'll get a call to do loads and unloads, or whatever it takes.
Right.
I never did get a call for, I may have gotten one call for that, but I get a call from the Oslo, and they needed some help on with little foxes doing props.
Yeah.
Okay, sure, why not? Get my foot in the door. Well, I went in there. My first job was to take all this artwork that the designer had specified and they had blown up, all these large classical oil paintings. I had to find frames out of inventory and or make the frames to fit these for the set. Set my workspace up, boom, 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 knocked it out. They said, well,
they had no idea.
Little to no instruction.
Right.
There was also four other Ringling graduates. We had a little power play going there just with who we, you know, Jeff Dean had gone to Ringling. Joanne Atkins, she was at Ringling. Carly Murdoch, who was there, and also Rick Allen, are all. So it was, you know, there was some camaraderie
right.
there, they said, well, you know, we've got this next show coming up was Beatsville.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see Beatsville?
I did. I know.
Yeah, I built. Many of the major props, they're the bar, the piano, benches, all that kind of stuff, and was like turning it around in like half the time.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they really did fall in love with me, and hopefully there'll be more calls for this. It's called an overhire.
Oh.
So, I mean, I found out a couple of weeks ago that I actually have a union retirement plan. They were taking a certain amount out of each check.
Oh.
It was going in a retirement fund. I went to my bank. I closed my accounts down at Wells Fargo. And, well, what's this? IATSE retire. So, yeah. So,
oh, lovely.
But, yeah, it's that's what we're hoping for.
Well, and I know that you volunteer all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I'm the technical director, obviously, for Sarasolo.
Right.
I was involved with Joe Morello doing the
upstairs at Starlight.
At Starlight. I actually worked with Tyler doing the whole rebranding of the Starlight from the time. Actually, I was brought in by the old owner of the Broadway to introduce me to Tyler.
Wow.
Because he was brought in to be like a general manager or a consultant, and I had known the woman who owns the Broadway. She knew I had theater background. She'd always wanted to sort of like massage that relationship with the theaters. That unless you're open regular hours, it's not going to happen. Because
no.
When I was at the Players in the old days, it was like four nights a week you were at the Broadway.
Right, right, right.
And
Tyler really has massaged that.
Well, the irony was is that we introduced, we met, we hit it off right off the bat, and then like the next week was the 4th of July weekend. On the 3rd of July, the entire staff walked out. They hadn't been paid in 8 weeks.
Oh my God!
And Tyler's going, okay. Well, he gathered his wits, went to the fellow who now owns the building, because she lost the building along the way, arranged to have it leased to him. And he had the idea, which I fully supported, was to, you know, it needed to be like a Sardi's.
Yes.
So, here's one of these glaring ironies. We couldn't really keep the Broadway Bar's name anymore because you had two groups of people. You had people who loved the Broadway Bar and would always support it, and those who went there once.
Uh-huh.
And because they still treated it like a dive, inconsistent, you know, so you couldn't keep the name. But the irony was is that we closed the Broadway Bar and opened a Broadway Bar.
Yes, I know.
I actually haven't done much work there lately. I was supposed to be the guy who all of the tech ran through. There was another show came in there. They brought there. It was a bunch of the people that were all went to school together at Booker.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're in the early 20s.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so they got the one guy who's up in Manatee Players. He's got a bunch of his stuff in there. And I'm just waiting for it all to fall apart.
Yeah,
I'm not,
I know. And then you'll come in and take care of it.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, my stuff is still there, and I will work with him whenever I need to.
Okay, so I have one other question.
Okay.
And it's hard to frame for you because of all the things that you've done, but essentially it is having given a life to this work, which it seems to me is creating things for other people to use. You know, in every area, people need some kind of design thing, and you know how to do that and have done it, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say about living a life doing that? What's that like, or what is that? What could you say about that?
I think in many ways what my the motivation is solving a problem.
Yes.
My vocabulary has always been a key to my skills, because although I had some learning issues when I was young, when I was in third grade, I had a 12th grade vocabulary in third grade. That's because we thought about things and we analyzed things.
Right.
And, you know, why is this funny? Why is this not funny? Why is Tom Lehrer funny?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, because I was with a group of, and the neighborhood I grew up in Chicago was, one side of the street was Jewish, one side of the street was Catholic.
Wow.
Okay, so I'm Armenian, so I'm somewhere floating in between.
I
spent as much time in synagogue as I did in the Armenian church. I was baptized in the Armenian church, which it may as well be Mars, because they make the Catholics look like Baptists.
Oh, wow.
I mean, because it's the gold Bibles and the beards and,
right.
Another language and Armenian school and the genocide and so an awful lot for a kid to take on,
right?
When it's not an entire part. And of course, my father at this point is
moving away.
Is. And he didn't have he didn't have any father role models himself.
No, right, of course not.
And, you know, so you just can't react.
Well, but I think that what you're saying is that you learned to try and make things right.
Yeah.
Right? To see all the sides.
To think before you react.
Yes, definitely to think before you react. But also that other thing, to see everybody's point of view and to somehow be a conduit, right? For everything that other people need, whether they're...
whether they're aware of it or not.
They're right, exactly. Well, I think that's probably right. I think that's probably right. I think probably you were able to see what other people needed, whether they were aware of it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Stephen. So, Steve uses all of his skills to help, to create for others what they want and need, even if they hadn't realized that this is what they wanted or needed. He's a creator. And as such, he demonstrates the capacity of we human beings to be so much, perhaps so much more than we even thought we were or could be. So when I play these interviews, it is my hope that when you're listening to Steve, you're thinking, is this how I feel about my life? Have I embraced everything that came my way? Have I opened my arms and my heart to myself to become all that I am? Well, if you think that that might not be true and you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Go up on my website, click on the email tab. I will answer any questions you have. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, but definitely something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten